Calls for the city of Bloomington to remove a farmers market vendor with alleged ties to white supremacy are growing. WFIU's Adam Pinsker reports the city has a plan to address the issue.
Members of the Bloomington Community and Family Resources Office say they'll host a forum sometime over the next few weeks after several vendors said they didn't feel safe at the downtown farmers market. The city's been under pressure to remove Sarah Dye and Doug McKay for their connection to white supremacist Nolan Brewer. Brewer, who was sentenced to prison for vandalizing a synagogue in Indiana, told FBI agents he communicated with Dye and McKay. The couple has also been linked to a neo-Nazi website. City officials say removing the couple could be a violation of their civil rights, but they are concerned about the allegations. Resident Thomas Westgard says the city has been dragging its heels on this issue for way too long.
Intentions and a quarter will get you a gumball. It's not about intentions. It's about taking concrete, specific actions that lead to a goal.
The chair of Bloomington's Parks Committee, which heard from residents Tuesday night, says the board could make a recommendation to City Council for the end of July. For WFIU News, I'm Adam Pinsker.
Bloomington police arrested an Indiana University professor at the city's farmers market Saturday after she held a sign outside a booth owned by vendors with alleged ties to white supremacy. WFIU's Adam Pinsker tells us why the professor's attorney says the case was mishandled.
Are you willing to leave? Otherwise, you are going to be subject to being arrested.
I'm not willing to leave.
Okay.
Bloomington police arrested 40-year-old IU history professor Kara Cadu after she refused to leave the city's farmers market Saturday. Video taken at the scene shows Cadu standing near the Schooner Creek farm booth holding a sign saying the vendors there, Sarah Dye and Doug McKay, harassed her. The couple have allegedly been tied with white supremacist groups. Gary Waddell of the group called Indiana 3% says he came to the market to make sure Dye was not being harassed.
I'm here to see that she can be able to conduct business without intimidation.
But Cadu's attorney says there were several other people near the booth harassing Schooner Creek protesters that were not arrested.
Hello and welcome to special coverage from the WFIU Newsroom. I'm City Limits Editor Bob Salzberg. News Bureau Chief Sarah Whitmire is joining me as we await remarks from Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about the decision to suspend the city's farmers market for 2 weeks. The mayor's decision came Monday after a woman was arrested for demonstrating in front of a booth of a vendor with alleged ties to white supremacist groups. But the uproar began many weeks ago when transcripts from an FBI interview with Nolan Brewer were published.
Brewer is a self-described white supremacist, and he pleaded guilty to vandalizing a synagogue in Carmel last year. He told FBI agents in an interview that he had communicated with Sarah Dye, and she's one of the co-owners of Schooner Creek Farm, which is the vendor in question here that has a booth at the farmers market. Dye and Doug McKay have since been the cause of protests at the Saturday market.
It's a really complicated issue. The city runs the market, and because it's not private, the city can't force Schooner Creek out based on its views. That would be a violation of the vendor's First Amendment rights. The city said the decision to shut down the entire market for 2 weeks was based on the escalating tension and conflict at the market over the last few weeks.
It looks like the room at City Hall where they're getting ready to go live in the council chambers is getting quite full with people who are there anticipating the mayor's remarks. And Bob, this really is a dramatic step. We were talking about this a little bit yesterday in the newsroom to actually close the market.
Yeah, I think it's worth taking a look at what's happened. I mean, we have Schooner Creek, and they've been tied to these white supremacist groups. Then there have been protesters who have come in to protest Schooner Creek in a safe way, in a quiet way. But then Antifa came in, and they're a very intimidating group, and they wanted to protect the protesters from the three percenters, which is another group that has shown up at the market now. And they, you know, according to a lot of reports, a lot of them were carrying guns when they were in the market last weekend. So you've got about three or four different layers of people who have taken this on as an issue.
And there is a place where protesters are allowed to protest, but it's sort of right off the city property there. And I think the issue this past Saturday was the woman who was arrested was actually standing right in front of Schooner Creek's booth holding a sign, and police did ask her multiple times to leave.
I think if you watch the videos, there were videos that were on social media, the police were very polite, very definitive. And so they arrested her and took her to jail. Now, they did drop the charges.
We're going to go live now to Mayor Hamilton's remarks.
Thank you for being here today. I'm John Hamilton, the mayor of Bloomington. 2 days ago, I announced that due to public safety concerns, I was directing the cancellation of the community farmers market for the next 2 Saturdays. I took this action based upon specific recommendations from our local public safety officials and after consulting with others locally and nationally. It was a very painful decision to suspend our beloved farmers market, affecting hundreds of local farmers and their families and thousands of patrons and visitors. But it was necessary because our first obligation is to protect public safety. Today, I want to share some background of the decision, continue our ongoing conversations, and also begin to chart the path forward in light of our current realities. We have work to do together, including more conversations to have to move forward and reclaim our community farmers market.
Longtime Indiana Senator Richard Lugar died Sunday at age 87. Lugar's most well-known bipartisan effort is one that would change the world forever. He worked with Democratic Senator Sam Nunn to help former Soviet states dismantle weapons of mass destruction and nuclear arsenals.
On my wall, I have a map of Russia, and I have a chart showing how many warheads have been taken off of missiles, how many missiles destroyed, how many submarines destroyed.
That was Lugar speaking in 2017. According to the Lugar Center, the Nunn-Lugar program has led to the deactivation of more than 7,500 nuclear warheads. Funeral services for the political icon are pending.
The public will get its first chance to bid farewell to Richard Lugar on Tuesday, when the former senator and Indianapolis mayor will lie in state at the State House. It's a relatively rare honor, last done in 2015 for State Representative Bill Crawford, the longest-serving African-American lawmaker in state history. Lugar's funeral will be Wednesday afternoon at St. Luke's United Methodist on the far north side of Indianapolis. The family will welcome as many attending as possible, but the service will also be live-streamed on the internet for those who can't be there in person.
More than 1,000 people, including some of the nation's most notable political figures, gathered in Indianapolis today to say their final goodbyes to Richard Lugar. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the Hoosier political titan's funeral.
Those who spoke at the service, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Vice President Mike Pence, all talked about Richard Lugar's legacy in the state, the country, and the world. Former Georgia Democratic Senator Sam Nunn famously partnered with Lugar to help dismantle thousands of nuclear warheads. Nunn hailed Lugar's commitment to cooperation and compromise, which he says are too often misunderstood today.
Some take it as meaning you give up your principles. Dick Lugar never, ever compromised his principles.
Lugar was the longest-serving Indiana senator, 36 years in office.
More than 500,000 students in Indiana will be out of school today as thousands of their teachers are expected to descend on the State House. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports that their action is part of a growing movement.
It won't be business as usual when Indiana lawmakers return to the State House today. There will be a sea of teachers wearing red pouring into the building, making a lot of noise, probably sounding something like this. That's the sound of hundreds of teachers inside the State House 8 months ago chanting, "Not okay." They were there to highlight Indiana's ranking as 36th in the country for average teacher pay. It's expected that more than 14,000 teachers and their supporters will show up at the Capitol today. The state's largest teachers union says more than 140 school districts are closing for the day.
A Bloomington mother wants to know why her son is still in a Venezuelan prison after she says he was supposed to be released in November. As WFIU's Barbara Brozier reports, Todd Leininger has been in prison there for nearly 5 years.
Todd Leininger and his wife were visiting her native country of Venezuela in 2014 when authorities there arrested them. They initially accused Todd of terrorism and weapons trafficking, but eventually lowered the charges to attempted homicide and concealment of a firearm. Todd's mother, Barbara, says the government's account of what happened isn't true, and her son was supposed to be released in November. But that didn't happen. Barbara's desperate to get him home because Todd's mental and physical health are deteriorating.
They're holding him hostage is what it amounts to. He is a hostage there. There's no legal reason to keep him there.
Barbara says she's been in touch with Representative Trey Hollingsworth and Senator Todd Young about her son's case. Both offices say they've been in contact with Barbara and are doing what they can to help. For WFIU News, I'm Barbara Brozier. A group of family and friends greeted Todd Leininger and his mother Barbara at the Indianapolis airport over the weekend, holding signs that said, "We love you and welcome home, Todd." Venezuelan authorities recently released Leininger from prison, although a court ordered his release back in November. Leininger says he's thankful for all the people who advocated for his freedom.
And I owe a lot of, gratitude to all the people who have been praying for me and doing many, many things to help me get out, because I know that all of those things work together to make sure that I'm home right now.
Leininger says he's not sure what the future holds, but he's looking forward to rebuilding his life in Indiana.
More than 100 kids skipped class Friday to stand in the cold and ask lawmakers to do something about global climate change. Rebecca Thiel reports it's part of 120 such events around the country and several around the world.
The international movement, the Youth Climate Strike, or Fridays for Future, was started by a Swedish teen named Greta Thunberg last year. She says she'll protest in front of her country's parliament building every Friday until it enacts more climate-friendly policies. Isabella Falahi is a sophomore at Carmel High School and one of the organizers of the Indianapolis event. She says state lawmakers have put things like the coal industry ahead of public health and the environment.
The reason why we're not in school right now is that we can't even go to school and study for a future that we may not even have because of their inaction.
A United Nations report says the world only has 11 years to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and avoid the catastrophic effects of climate change.
Nonprofit pay must be reported to the IRS. We use those tax forms in our reporting, and we'll warn you, this story includes a lot of numbers. IU Health President and CEO Dennis Murphy was compensated nearly $2.52 million in 2017. Data collected by OpenTheBooks.com shows that's in the ballpark with what 81 other nonprofit health systems pay their CEOs. In addition, a 2016 tax form reports that 13 of 15 individuals who served on the IU Health Board during that year received pay, from $46,500 on the high end to a low of $15,250 for a reported 6 hours work per week. An IU Health spokesman says because of the complexity and demands of the job, board members are paid in line with what other large health systems pay.
Bloomington's downtown is rapidly changing as new apartments, hotels, and businesses go up. As the city continues to grow, many wonder what it can mean for affordability. As part of our City Limits project, we're answering your questions about the changing community. One resident asked, what's being done to ensure there is affordable housing among the new apartments and home construction around town? Barbara Brozier seeks out the answer in part one of our series on affordable housing.
When Kelly Toto moved her family to Bloomington for a better life, she wasn't prepared for the rent price that would come with it.
$700 seemed outrageous. Back home, it was like $500 for a full house.
Like most renters, she had no choice but to pay the price the market demanded. But her luck and her life changed when she moved just steps from the Beeline Trail to Habitat for Humanity's Trailview neighborhood.
I cried, I think, the first year every time I looked around at my house.
The city and Habitat want to give more people an opportunity to own a home in the city they love, so they announced a new partnership this week. Mayor John Hamilton says they'll work together to build a new neighborhood southwest of town for up to 50 families.
Osage Place will offer homes for new residents who have household earnings between 25 and 80% a very median income.
The city will pay up to $800,000 in infrastructure costs associated with the project. It's the Hamilton administration's latest effort to address the lack of affordable housing in Bloomington. Wendy Goodlett is CEO of Habitat, and she says the need is dire.
We have nearly 20 families currently in our program, and they deserve a decent place to live today.
And that need is only expected to increase. The city's 2018 comprehensive plan predicts the population will surpass 100,000 people over the next 20 years, which means Bloomington will need more than 12,000 additional housing units.
I think it's a critical issue. We have a housing crisis in this community.
That's Deborah Meyerson, Executive Director of South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities. The nonprofit focuses on expanding housing options for low and moderate income households in six counties. She says housing affordability is particularly challenging in Monroe County.
There's two ways to lower the cost of housing. It's either to make rent or housing payment less or to increase wages. And so to manage housing costs, you need to do either of those. And the city and Monroe County has both considerations. They have high housing costs and low wages.
A 2018 report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition says Bloomington has the most expensive housing in the state, and someone would have to work more than two full-time jobs at minimum wage to afford a two-bedroom, fair market rate apartment. Meyerson says that's one of the reasons her organization is partnering with the city on Switchyard Apartments.
It's a terrific location. It's on a bus line. It's near the Beeline Trail.
The 16 units will only be available to low-income households, and they're going up right next to Switchyard Park. Hamilton says the city is leasing the land to the nonprofit for just $1.
One of the challenges when you build a beautiful new park, you create value all around it. Another way to say that is prices go up around a new park like that. And so one of our commitments was to figure out how do we make sure we don't gentrify, if you will, or we don't drive the mix of incomes that are there now away from that park.
Another affordable housing complex is further along in Bloomington's Trades District. Beeline Heights will serve families at or below 60% of the area median income, with two units reserved for those below 50%. The city says that brings the number of affordable units it's added or rehabbed to more than 600 in the past few years. But Meyerson says it will take more to meet the need.
We need more housing supply. We need more housing subsidies for lower incomes. We need to figure out how to build the housing for households that don't qualify for subsidies.
That includes looking at the large number of residents who earn above the median income and still struggle to make rent or mortgage payments. The city's comprehensive plan says more than 80% of Bloomington households spend nearly half their annual income on housing and transportation. Hamilton says the public and private sector have to work together to change that.
There is a danger that Bloomington could get so expensive that you can become what's called a barbell city, where you have really high-cost housing and you have really heavily subsidized housing and you don't have a lot in the middle.
Preventing that from happening, experts say, will require a solution that expands beyond the city's limits. For WFIU News, I'm Barbara Brozier. The same year Pete Buttigieg won his first term as South Bend mayor, Newsweek included the community on a list of dying cities. What is particularly troubling for this small city is that the number of young people declined by 2.5% during the previous decade, casting further doubt on whether this city will ever be able to recover, the article said. Buttigieg saw that as a rallying cry.
I ran for mayor in 2011 knowing that nothing like Studebaker would ever come back, but believing that we would, our city would, if we had the courage to reimagine our future.
The former Studebaker plant where Buttigieg announced his run for president is now being repurposed as a tech hub. And it's that kind of innovation, Buttigieg says, he would bring to the White House.
And a moment like that calls for hopeful and audacious voices from communities like ours. And yes, it calls for a new generation of leadership in this country.
Buttigieg has pointed to his successes as mayor as qualification enough for the nation's highest office, even though no one in history has ever made such a leap. He boasts about the more than $100 million in economic development downtown seen since South Bend's Smart Street Initiative, which most notably converted one-way streets to two-way. And he talks about reversing the trend of people leaving South Bend. U.S. Census data shows an estimated population increase of 1% from 2010 to 2017.
More people are moving into South Bend than we've seen in a generation. Thousands of new jobs have been added in our area. Billions in investment.
But even some of Buttigieg's supporters acknowledge much of that investment went to downtown. Here's South Bend resident Juan Mendoza.
Well, I feel like he should try to focus more on the neighborhoods, the young people.
The city did spend money in neighborhoods as part of Buttigieg's plan to address 1,000 vacant properties in 1,000 days. The city repaired some homes, but tore most of them down, leaving several empty lots on some blocks. And other critics, including Indiana's Republican Party, are quick to point out Buttigieg doesn't deserve sole credit for the city's successes. In a press release sent out ahead of his presidential announcement, the Republican Party points out the state gave $3.5 million through its Regional Cities Initiative to help restore the shuttered Studebaker building. Andrew Downs is executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics.
Looking at his record more carefully, points out that Studebaker wasn't just him. In fact, a lot of people would argue it's not him, it's several other entities. They can make an argument about the Chase building downtown. That was not him, it's a bunch of people. Now, he can turn that into an asset. He can say, see, I know how to work with people. But those who are looking to criticize what he has said have an easy avenue there.
Down says how Buttigieg reacts to those criticisms as his national profile increases will be key to his campaign success heading into 2020. And Down says another weak point opponents will likely latch on to is Buttigieg's lack of experience dealing with more complex issues like international affairs. But the lack of traditional experience some will fault him for is what also appeals to many of his fans. Joseph Leeper drove 27 hours from Flagstaff, Arizona, to see Buttigieg make his presidential announcement.
I think the actual on-the-ground experience he's had here in South Bend, being mayor and doing the day-to-day, the bottom-up experience is pretty valuable, and you could stack it against any other kind of experience that a lot of the other candidates may have.
The big question is whether the young mayor of South Bend will be able to keep the momentum going into 2020.
7 million Americans are more than 90 days behind on their car loans. Delinquency rates are nearing their peak from the Great Recession. As WFIU's Tyler Lake reports, it's the younger and poorer buyers that are ending up underwater.
That's a driver carefully unloading a hauler full of cars. Behind him, banners flap in the wind with buy here, pay here, and hot deals written on them. Inside, sales representatives are waiting for another customer.
We would have to scrape the customers off the ceiling because when they would see that number, I mean, they would jump up and get physically, you know, you could tell they were very upset at that number.
That's Neil Welliver. He used to sell cars. He says that was part of a sales tactic designed to shock customers with an eye-watering monthly payment.
We would basically follow up and say, well, how close to these numbers can you come? And right then, a lot of the folks, when they walked in, were thinking, you know, I'd want to be at $200 or $300 a month. Then they mentally bumped themselves to a higher figure after seeing those large inflated numbers.
Welliver started out working for his father and his uncles, but it wasn't until he left the family business that he saw the truly aggressive side of car sales. He says after shocking buyers with that high monthly payment, dealerships would work with numbers, stretch out loan lengths, and adjust down payments until the buyer feels they can afford the purchase. It's one way to distract buyers from paying attention to the actual cost of the car. Welliver says if buyers stay focused on monthly payments, they might not realize how much they're spending overall or how long they'll be paying off the loan. And that can get people into trouble. Of the 7 million Americans over 90 days past due on their loans, most are from young buyers, those with weak credit, or often both. Aaron Macy, senior policy analyst at the Indiana Institute for Working Families, says auto finance companies are a big part of the problem.
Banks have to be accountable to, you know, federal regulators who are looking at safety and soundness and looking at risk. auto finance companies don't have that. So as long as they're achieving a return, they can take on more risk.
And that's exactly what those lenders are doing. Half of the loans from auto finance companies are to borrowers with a subprime credit score. Those poor credit loans account for a quarter or less of the loans held by credit unions and banks. Phil Schumann is the director of financial literacy at Indiana University. He says many of these loans are through buy here, pay here lots that aggressively market to customers with poor credit.
Because, I mean, you hear those advertisements all the time. No credit, bad credit, anything like that. We can help you out. And then they add the tagline or something like that. We're just here to help you or something along those lines. Well, no. Like, they're not helping you if they're going to help dig you further into debt.
Schumann says while the dealer may try to distract buyers from the actual cost of the car, it's up to the consumers to do their homework. But people are spending more than ever on used cars. According to Experian, the average used vehicle loan payment tipped over $400 a month last year. One reason for that is people are buying larger vehicles like SUVs and trucks, but stagnant income and high-paying jobs being replaced by lower-paying work is also driving the delinquency rate up. So to lower monthly payments, buyers are now stretching out the life of the loan.
So it used to be that car loans were, you know, you could say like 4 years. Now we're talking they're going into the 7-year terms.
That makes the monthly payment cheaper, but it leaves buyers on the hook for a lot longer, often paying on a car that is worth less than what they owe even years after purchasing it. Schumann says 5 years is as long as he would recommend for a car loan. He also says you shouldn't spend more than 15% of your total income on a car, and you should always put 20% down on your purchase up front. For WFIU News, I'm Tyler Lake.
As counties across the state grapple with exploding jail populations, some state lawmakers are looking at ways to give them relief. They're proposing changes that include directing more funding to counties and sending some felons back to prisons. But in part one of a 2-part reporting series on jail overcrowding, WFIU's Barbara Brozier explains why some worry those are temporary fixes to a larger incarceration crisis.
Danica Kennedy has been at the Hancock County Jail for nearly a month. She's housed in a cell block that's so full, several women are sleeping on bunk beds in the common area. The constant commotion makes it hard to stay focused. Even the smallest of problems can escalate into fights.
You have people who get upset because it's a lime in the shower, it's razor day, and somebody jumps in front of them.
On this particular day, there are 211 people in a jail meant to house fewer than 160. That doesn't include the 70 inmates jail commander Keith Oliver says they're paying other counties to house.
Last year, we spent almost $600,000 sending other inmates to other counties.
The problem extends well beyond this jail. A 2018 report from the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute shows 77% of the state's jails were at or over capacity. Police and prosecutors across the state will tell you the reasons are multifaceted. They blame the opioid epidemic for an uptick in drug offenses and violent crime. And criminal code reform legislators passed a few years ago means level 6 felons are taking up valuable space in their facilities instead of serving their sentences in prison.
I believe that we, as a state of Indiana, changed the criminal code, have played a big part in the jail overcrowding, and I think we should resolve it.
That's Representative Randy Fry, who authored a bill to ease the burden criminal code reform placed on local jails. It would allow counties to request the Department of Correction take in convicted level 6 felons if their facility is at capacity. The DOC would house those inmates in regional holding facilities that it would open in buildings it already owns, like shuttered prisons.
Well, currently, there's no funding in the bill for additional revenue to DOC. So the way we fund it now is that the $35 a day per diem that the county gets when they have a prisoner is then transferred to Department of Corrections while they have the prisoner.
Research from the Vera Institute for Justice, a nonprofit that aims to reduce mass incarceration, points to a bigger problem. Jasmine Heiss is the director of outreach and public affairs for Vera's In Our Backyards initiative. She says Indiana is an outlier when it comes to its jail population.
We're in this moment that's often talked about as sort of the reversal of mass incarceration. Indiana, in many ways, has been moving or staying in the opposite direction.
Heiss says no other state has increased its jail population so dramatically in the past decade. Dozens of Indiana counties are considering building new jails as a result. In Hancock County, some residents expressed concerns during a recent public hearing about a proposed new jail. Oliver says they need the facility to comply with state and federal requirements.
To allow for staff to be more safe, to allow inmates to be safer in our facility, this is something we have to do.
Voters here rejected a request in May to fund the project through a property tax increase. So now the county council wants to raise local income taxes by 0.2%. Greenfield resident Matthew Kofer says he wants the leaders to consider other alternatives.
For instance, rehabilitation for people who are capable of being rehabilitated, restitution to the victims of crime. Instead of just locking them up in the local jail, make them do something useful.
He questions whether building a new jail is the best solution in a place some jokingly call Handcuff County.
Some residents of South Bend, Indiana, are raising questions after the shooting death of a black resident by a white police officer. Mayor Pete Buttigieg came off the presidential campaign trail to deal with concerns over bias and the use of body cameras. Justin Hicks of member station WVPE reports.
It was about 3:30 in the morning on Father's Day when Sergeant Ryan O'Neill was dispatched to investigate a call about someone breaking into cars.
There's a suspect in the north parking lot wearing all dark clothing with a flashlight, possibly breaking out windows.
Prosecutors say when the officer arrived, he saw two legs sticking out of a car, and that when he approached, Eric Logan turned around holding a large knife in one hand. Officer O'Neill told prosecutors he yelled several times for Logan to drop the knife before firing two shots, one into his stomach. Logan was rushed in a police car to the hospital where he later died. And that's about all we know, because Sergeant O'Neill never turned on his body or dashboard cameras. Without footage, there's questions not only about the shooting, but about why Logan was transported to a nearby hospital in a police car rather than an ambulance. South Bend is a city of just over 100,000 people located near Chicago. More than a quarter of residents are black, and the news hit Brenda Bailey hard.
It sank.
During his 7.5 years as mayor, Pete Buttigieg has had uneasy relations with some in South Bend's black community. After the shooting, he left the campaign trail, returning home to coordinate the investigation.
I thought it was important sooner rather than later for us to make clear how this process is going to work and also to state the community's values.
Logan's family members met with Buttigieg and say he promised transparency as the investigation progresses. Shifonia Logan is Eric Logan's wife.
It's a lot of rumors out there, but nobody know what went on but the police and him. He's not here to tell it.
Documents from an internal police investigation also surfaced, showing that trainees had accused O'Neill of making racist remarks about blacks and Muslims while on duty. The department determined them to be, quote, not sustained. The major focus has been on body cameras and why O'Neill's wasn't turned on. Councilmember Regina Williams-Preston says the city spent $1.5 million on cameras to try to avoid situations like this.
How can we trust our police department when we put all of those elements in place, but we don't follow through?
Mayor Buttigieg ordered the chief of police to notify officers that body cameras were expected to be on during all interactions with civilians. At a swearing-in ceremony for new officers, he encouraged them to act with restraint and equity.
We gather in the wake of a shooting that has left family members grieving the loss of someone they love, and also leaves an officer and his family dealing with the consequences of that encounter.
Late Wednesday, a meeting to talk about gun violence took on a new life in the wake of the shooting. More than 50 community leaders and activists stood in a large circle on an outdoor basketball court. Pete Buttigieg showed up unannounced and listened, sometimes taking direct criticism. Here's Wayne Hubbard.
I know it's not your fault you were not here when it happened, but these systems were here. They have to stop. People are dying.
While the investigation continues, Buttigieg is set to return to the campaign trail today with events scheduled in Florida and South Carolina.
It's been more than a year now since the United States trade conflict with China began. The tariffs have hit everything from cars to lumber, and farmers are caught in the crossfire. WFIU's Brock Turner has more on how Republican lawmakers are shifting their rhetoric and trying to hold the support of farmers.
David Myers has been farming this land in Decatur County for generations. He supported President Donald Trump in 2016 and serves on the Agriculture Committee for Indiana Senator Mike Braun.
See that year? He's pollinated fairly, really good. But the problem is his kernels are real shallow, so he needs moisture to give some depth to those kernels.
Tariffs and seasons like these might not be helping his balance sheets, but Myers says he has no intent of supporting another candidate come 2020.
In my opinion, the president is doing exactly the right thing.
Myers admits this season has been hard for Hoosier farmers, but says he understands and appreciates the tough negotiating tactics President Trump is using with the Chinese government.
Have contacted a lot of people throughout the state, a lot of farmers throughout the state, and I've never heard anyone say that Trump's not doing the right thing. And I sincerely believe that he is. Is it painful in the short term? Yes, it is. But long term, we're going to be a lot better off.
And that's a sentiment that Indiana Farmers Union President James Benham believes too.
Probably not as optimistic as they were at one point in time. I think they feel that supportive. They know that China's been a problem for us to deal with for many generations.
But Republicans who have traditionally benefited from the support of farmers are starting to face tough questions after what many describe as a perfect storm. In addition to the tariffs, the wet spring has kept farmers across the country from being able to plant their fields. Just in Indiana, there are millions of unplanted acres. The United States Department of Agriculture is set to distribute about $14.5 billion to farmers later this year as direct incentives for what the department calls, quote, unjustified retaliation. But unplanted ground isn't eligible for the payments. As a result, Braun and fellow Republicans are preparing farmers for a long conflict.
Got a lot of bad behavior out there, and farmers know that. President Trump has been there to help farmers get through it with soybeans, and I think that will continue. So I think it's going to be longer rather than shorter. I just try to say things honestly and hoping that there is some breakthrough. I just don't sense that's going to happen.
Aaron Kane says he understands the long-term goal, but isn't sure how much longer he can hold on.
I appreciate that someone's holding him in check. Unfortunately, you know, it's bleeding my bottom line.
Many farmers say they believe if China won't purchase American soybeans, other countries will. But experts say Brazil, Argentina, and other nations have already started to produce more soybeans, and those markets won't easily return. Andreas Hausgret is a clinical professor at Indiana University's Kelley School of Business.
This will be a question of survival for many, particularly, but not only, smaller farmers. And I must say, when I look at this, I'm almost heartbroken, and it's difficult. From a rational perspective, and it's difficult for a professor of economics to understand that this group that is clearly a victim of the current policies supports the people who are in charge and responsible for those policies. It's irrational.
I don't think it's the economist to say what's in the mind of the farmer. That bothers me, because he's saying farmer's not going to vote in his best interest. He's going to vote. Farmers are very patriotic, and they're going to vote for what's best for this country, not some radical idea that somebody has that a percentage of the population likes because they're going to get a benefit out of it.
Hausgret says he expects things will continue to get worse for farmers, and that the short-term benefits of these subsidies will not make up for the long-term damage done to the market. Benham says many farmers are realistic. He believes most understand the ramifications of a trade war, but says many farmers remain faithful to President Trump because it's the only hope they believe there is.
I haven't heard the first Democrat come out and really say something, you know, I've got a plan. If you elect me, we're going to do this for agriculture. I haven't heard that. And so they thought, why would anybody in my industry then go jumping at a rally someplace for a party that's it's not really digging down deep and saying, look, you know, folks, we're going to have to spend another $10 billion on farm industry to keep these people in business.
Corn and soybean farmers are making less money per acre than they have in years. As WFIU's Brock Turner reports, some are trading corn and soybeans for solar panels.
Mark Simons has been farming for 44 years. The majority of his nearly 1,000 acres are corn and soybeans. But he's in the process of adding another crop into his rotation, one that also relies on the weather.
The word solar farm kind of capsulizes it, because
the electrons produced out there are just another crop. Instead of producing carbohydrates, we're producing clean, renewable energy that goes on for a long time.
He says he'll have his 4,500 modules up, running, and delivering electricity to the grid before the end of the year. Simons is joining a growing number of farmers across the country who are hoping to diversify their revenue streams. Experts say the number has increased significantly since the cost of solar panels decreased about 10 years ago. That cost decrease made the math work for Simons.
To me, it's another crop. That's how I look at it, and that's how any businessman would look at it, I think. You just got to compare the costs and the revenue.
But as with most crops, producers are reliant upon a number of factors that determine the price they get.
Utilities have a lot of political power, a lot of money behind them. They would like to see power production stay in their hands rather than making it more egalitarian through more distributed energy. I think the big money wants to, you know, maintain their control of the power system.
Simons says his provider is supportive, and without it, he couldn't be starting this project. But the end goal of utilities and electric providers is important to remember. Rural electric cooperatives, which serve a large portion of Hoosiers living in those areas, are nonprofits. Their primary goal is to provide cheap power to less dense areas where the economics don't make sense for private providers to operate.
When we do a deal, we're always looking to see how does this stand up on its own. So we don't want to overpay for power.
That's Brian Anderson. He's the Director of Economic Development and Public Relations at the Wabash Valley Power Alliance.
Good morning. This is regional news coverage from the WFIU Newsroom. I'm Sarah Whitmire. The Evansville School District violated a transgender student's rights by restricting access to the bathroom of the student's identified gender. That's according to a new court ruling. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a federal judge's decision in the case from 2018.
An Evansville student who was born female has identified as male since he was 11 years old, and when in high school he wanted to use the boys' restroom, the school district said no, and the ACLU of Indiana filed a lawsuit. The student took hormone therapy, and as federal judge William Lawrence writes, he is very unlikely to be mistaken for a girl at this point. Yet the school argued that only if the student's birth certificate were changed could he use the boys' restroom, and even then the school might still stop him. It did offer him a gender-neutral bathroom, but it was frequently unavailable. Judge Lawrence says the school violated both Title IX and the 14th Amendment, and the student might be eligible for money from the district. That would be decided later by a jury. The ACLU says it hopes the ruling puts other Indiana school districts on notice. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
South Bend Mayor and presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg is speaking this morning at Indiana University Bloomington's auditorium. The speech is scheduled to begin at 11 o'clock. WFIU's Adam Pinsker is live at the auditorium. And Adam, people are lined up to get inside.
Yes, Sarah, they sure are. In fact, I've been here about 15 minutes now, and the line's grown just a little bit. The issue here is you have to have a ticket to get inside. Those tickets were distributed yesterday, but some of the folks here are on a standby line hoping that they'll get access to an unclaimed ticket.
What can we expect Buttigieg to talk about this morning, or is it a campaign rally?
Well, the title of the event is America and the World, National Security for a New Era. And given that, it is fitting that former Indiana Congressman Lee Hamilton, chair of the Committee on Foreign Affairs, will introduce Buttigieg at this morning's event.
Okay, thanks, Adam. That's Adam Pinsker reporting live this morning from outside the IU auditorium, where presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg will hold a campaign event later this morning.
Dry weather last week allowed Hoosier farmers to make progress planting their crops, but this season still lags far behind previous ones. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, 67% of Indiana's corn crop was in the ground as of June 9th. That compares with 98% this time last year. Purdue University professor Bob Nielsen says he estimates there are about 2 million unplanted acres of corn left across the state, and soybeans also lag far behind previous years.
We've just never had as many acres involved with that decision as we have this year, and that's what makes it different.
Farmers say planting corn anytime after June 1st is risky. Rethinking the way we reduce, reuse, and recycle could create high-quality jobs in Indiana. That was one takeaway from the keynote address in this year's Indiana Recycling Coalition Conference. Speaker and plastics expert Ken Miller says when a product will eventually be returned to the company that made it, it's more likely to be manufactured in a way that's more durable and reusable. And he says this kind of circular economy requires all kinds of jobs, including manufacturing and transportation. Recycling Coalition Executive Director Allison Mitchell says Indiana excels at both.
I think we are well positioned as a state to add that third ingredient of innovation to take advantage of the infrastructure that we already have.
Mitchell says Indianapolis's sustainability plan, Thrive Indianapolis, includes expanding recycling access as well as encouraging investments in these kinds of economies. She says that can look like anything from a traditional milkman service with reusable glass bottles to car sharing services like Blue Indy. Some companies in Indiana are already looking into ways to turn plastics into fuel for cars and jets.
And Fair Oaks Farms home delivery service has temporarily suspended deliveries in part to protect drivers it says are facing harassment following the release of a graphic undercover video showing workers abusing calves. For WFIU News, I'm Sarah Whitmire.